Chapter 10. A slow nature such as Morris's appears insensitive, for it needs time even to feel. Its instinct is to assume that nothing, either for good or evil, has happened, and to resist the invader. Once gripped, it feels acutely, and its sensations in love are particularly profound. Given time, it can know and impart ecstasy. Given time, it can sink to the heart of hell. Thus it was that his agony began, as a slight regret. Sleepless nights and lonely days must intensify it into a frenzy that consumed him. It worked inwards, till it touched the root whence body and soul both spring. The eye that he had been trained to obscure, and realized at last, doubled its power and grew superhuman, for it might have been joy. New worlds broke loose in him at this, and he saw from the vastness of the ruin what ecstasy he had lost, what a communion. They did not speak again for 2 days. Durham would have made it longer, but most of their friends were now in common, and they were bound to meet. Realizing this, he wrote Morris an icy note, suggesting that it would be a public convenience if they behaved as if nothing had happened. He added, "I shall be obliged if you will not mention my criminal morbidity to anyone. I am sure you will do this from the sensible way in which you took the news." Morris did not reply, but first put the note with the letters he had received during the vac, and afterwards burnt them all. He supposed the climax of agony had come. But he was fresh to real suffering, as to reality of any kind. They had yet to meet. On the second afternoon they found themselves in the same four at tennis, and the pain grew excruciating. He could scarcely stand or see. If he returned Durham's service, the ball sent a throb up his arm. Then they were made to be partners. Once they jostled. Durham winced, but managed to laugh in the old fashion. Moreover, it proved convenient that he should come back to college in Morris's sidecar. He got in without demur. Morris, who had not been to bed for 2 nights, went light-headed, turned the machine into a by-lane, and travelled top speed. There was a wagon in front, full of women. He drove straight at them, but when they screamed, stuck on his brakes, and just avoided disaster. Durham made no comment. As he indicated in his note, he only spoke when others were present. All other intercourse was to end. That evening Morris went to bed as usual, but as he laid his head on the pillows, a flood of tears oozed from it. He was horrified. A man crying. Fanshawe might hear him. He wept, stifled in the sheets. He sprang about, kissing, then struck his head against the wall and smashed the crockery. Someone did come up the stairs. He grew quiet at once and did not recommence when the footsteps died away. Lighting a candle, he looked with surprise at his torn pyjamas and trembling limbs. He continued to cry, for he could not stop, but the suicidal point had been passed, and remaking the bed, he lay down. His gyp was clearing away the ruins when he opened his eyes. It seemed queer to Morris that a gyp should have been dragged in. He wondered whether the man suspected anything, then slept again. On waking the second time, he found letters on the floor, one from old Mr. Grace, his grandfather, about the party that was to be given when he came of age, another from a don's wife asking him to lunch. "Mr. Durham is coming too, so you won't be shy." Another from Ada with mention of Gladys Olcott. Yet again he fell asleep. Madness is not for everyone, but Morris's proved the thunderbolt that dispels the clouds. The storm had been working up not for 3 days as he supposed, but for 6 years. It had brewed in the obscurities of being where no eye pierces. His surroundings had thickened it. It had burst, and he had not died. The brilliancy of day was around him. He stood upon the mountain range that overshadows youth. He saw. Most of the day he sat with open eyes, as if looking into the valley he had left. It was all so plain now. He had lied. He phrased it, "been fed upon lies," but lies are the natural food of boyhood, and he had eaten greedily. His first resolve was to be more careful in the future. He would live straight, not because it mattered to anyone now, but for the sake of the game. He would not deceive himself so much. He would not, and this was the test, pretend to care about women when the only sex that attracted him was his own. He loved men, and always had loved them. He longed to embrace them, and mingle his being with theirs. Now that the man who returned his love had been lost, he admitted this.